just saw one the other day.
A quiet man?
Please don't tell anyone.
Quiet man.
He turned that smile on me. It made me feel like I was a kid again. Back home. On a farm.
That smile, like my mama,
lifting me up, the sun in her eyes, and the sun in the sky, putting the sun right in my heart. Well, that was what it reminded me of. Well, that was what it reminded me of. My mama lifting me high. The sun in her eyes. The sun in the sky.
That was a portion of Back Home, a track from Hope Cries for Justice, the new album by William Parker and Patricia Nicholson. William Parker and Patricia Nicholson are my guests on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and this is the Burning Ambulance Podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS Podcast Network. If this is your first time listening, welcome. And if you've been with us for a while, welcome back. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and many other podcast aggregators, so I hope you'll subscribe, maybe give us a star rating or write a review. But first and foremost, thanks for listening. You should also consider visiting osirispod.com to learn more about the 24 other podcasts they host, which cover all kinds of subjects from music to craft brewing to comedy to writing and much, much more. I'm confident that when you go through their list of programs, you'll find at least one or two more that you'll find interesting. And if you want to support Burning Ambulance directly, please consider donating to patreon.com/burningambulance. If you're any kind of fan of avant-garde jazz, you probably already know who William Parker is. He's a bassist who's been on the scene since the 1970s. His first recorded appearance was in 1973, backing saxophonist Frank Lowe on the album Black Beings, which is an absolutely tremendous record on the ESP disc label. Since then, he's made literally hundreds of albums. He was the bassist in the David S. Ware Quartet for something like 20 years and continued working with David Ware all the way up until his death in 2012. He played with Cecil Taylor in the 1980s and 1990s. He was the bassist in Matthew Shipp's trio for a long time, and he's played with almost everyone else you've ever heard of in this genre of music. And he's done almost as much work as a leader as he's done, you know, as a sideman. He's done everything from solo bass albums to massive orchestral projects and is constantly showing up with something new and fascinating. Patricia Nicholson is his wife, and she is also a hugely important figure in the New York avant-garde jazz scene because she runs the annual Vision Festival, which is being held this year, May 2018, at Roulette in Brooklyn. Every year since 1996, Patricia has put together a massive week-long event that gathers amazing musicians from all over the spectrum, from guys who've been around since the 1960s to people who've just made their debut in the last few years and are keeping the spirit of free music alive. She's also a dancer and choreographer who performs at the festival every year, and she's just made her debut as a spoken word performer on the album Hope Cries for Justice, which opened up this program. So, in this interview, I'm talking to William about what he's doing musically, and I'm talking to Patricia about her thoughts on dance and on Hope Cries for Justice and on what it takes to run the Vision Festival and all the other programs that the nonprofit Arts for Art, which she leads, put on every year. They're an extremely ambitious organization working in a city and a cultural environment that offers equal parts apathy and hostility. But what they do under those circumstances is pretty amazing. So I hope you'll find this conversation as interesting and inspiring as I did. I'm going to play one more piece of music, as I always do before the interview starts. This is the title track from a new 3-CD box set, Voices Fall from the Sky, which focuses on pieces William wrote for vocalists. This song, Voices Fall from the Sky, features Amirtha Kadambi on vocals, Steve Swell on trombone, Jason Cao Wang on violin, and William on bass. So listen to a little bit of that, and then you'll hear my interview with William Parker and Patricia Nicholson. William, you started playing the bass when you were like 17 or 18, right? So how long do you think it took you to develop your own voice?
Well, I think my own voice was there. I think, you know, every musician, I think they start out with their own voice. It's a matter of keeping it and letting it come out and sort of realize that you've got power in your imperfections, and you've got power in the things you can't do as well as the things you can do. And what I mean by that is when I was studying, you know, it was one point where you know, you listen to bass players, and you, like, say for instance Paul Chambers, and you say, okay, that is the example of what you're supposed to do in the bass, and then you try to play like Paul Chambers, and whatever you do, it comes out the opposite of Paul Chambers, and you realize that, okay, well, you know something, that's not going to happen in this lifetime. And then you realize that everyone has got kind of a musical DNA, and that I've got to find, the reason I can't play like Paul Chambers is that I'm not Paul Chambers. So you found out, I was lucky enough to try to find a way that I could play. And then it kind of creeps up on you, you know. But I think one of the key things is to play, play. I mean, in the 70s, we played 24 hours, 7 days a week, as long as we could, and it comes out eventually. You know, no transcribing of solos, no studying a particular technique, but just playing straight, hardcore improvisation, and it began to come out. Theories about music and ideas about music and one's personality. And then you find that your personality is there, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. right in front of you.
But you, when you were coming up, you studied with a lot of guys like Charlie Hayden, Richard Davis, Art Davis, Jimmy Garrison, Wilbur Ware, all these guys. So what were you hoping to pick up from them?
Well, just a foothold into the world of music. How do you open this door called music? And can you give me a combination? Can you give me, is it safe? Is it kind? What's behind that door? And each person had a different idea. I mean, the first person I talked to was Charlie Hayden, and he told me about playing along with records. He said that's how I learned to play the bass. I learned to play the bass playing along with records. Richard Davis. I studied with up at the Jazzmobile. At that time, was playing in the orchestra. He was playing with Barbara Streisand. He was doing all of this stuff, studio work, and playing with Mel Lewis, Thad Jones, Big Band on Monday night. So his idea was to be versatile, all-round bass player, to be able to tackle the job. And one of the things he said was, if you're playing with a band, if the band isn't like the keenest band, you want them to say, well, the band wasn't happening, but the bass player was. So you always put all what you had into it, and the goal is to try to make the music, help the music to come to life. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Garrison, we went through the Samandel book, and we talked about just techniques of the bass, but it was never about what kind of music I was going to play. It was never about, I want you to be able to tackle anything. He wanted me more to be myself than try to be able to play everything in the world. Mm-hmm. And Milt Hinton was talking about playing, again, simplicity, about playing, when you play a C blues, you play just the note C, and before you play another note. And Wilbur Ware was talking about totally being yourself. Because everything he taught me, if I played it the way he played it, he would say I was wrong. And he'd play something, then I play it exactly the way he played it, he said, no, you're wrong. Then when I played it my way, he said, that's it. So all of this kind of helped me to point me in the road of finding oneself, which is just being open to a universe of music that kind of comes through you. And then when you actually play with people, going down to Studio Wee, going down to Studio Ribby, playing at the Ladies Fort, playing at all the lofts and playing at fashion shows, playing with poets, playing with all of these people, you begin to hone in on different vibrations that come through you and inform you of the power of music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is that kind of how you strike the balance in a way between, because you were saying, you know, in the early 70s, things were basically as free as they got, you know, I mean, in terms of total improvisation and stuff like that. But then you always had an interest in Ellington and in more structured music as well. And that's something that I feel like the same dichotomy exists in Cecil Taylor, who you worked with. You know, I mean, he was extremely free on the surface, but then had a tremendous admiration for Ellington and for, like, Horace Silver. So how did all that stuff kind of combine?
Well, I would first of all say that free is a structure. So when people say, well, this music has no structure, yeah, it's free. That's a structure. And it's really hard to play music with no structure. We talked about this for hours with my comrades, Daniel Carter and Billy Bang and Malik Baraka in the early days, how that everything has structure and the structures are different. And that nothing is really abstract because it's all coming out of nature. And in nature, there are no circles, perfect circles in nature. There are no squares in nature. There are no triangles in nature. They're not these geometric shapes. All the shapes are more free and open and what one would call abstract. But my initial entrance into the music was through my father playing us Duke Ellington every night when I was 5 or 6 years old, 7 years old, and listening to the fundamental music of Coleman Hawkins, Ben Webster, Johnny Hodges, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and all of the whole jazz tradition. See, that's in my generation, that's what we listened to. We listened to that. We listened to R&B from a more peripheral view for myself, but for some people it was closer. You listened to blues depending on which part of the country you came from. So it was all like inside of you. And if you looked at it as you say, this is black music, then black music could encompass all of these musics. And then if you say it's world music, then you have other elements from all over the world that can be included. And then if you say it's space music, then you have all of these elements from that's in space, that's in nature, that's everything's involved. And so if you just winds down to it, it's just music and we can use anything we want. The freedom is the freedom to choose what you want to play, when you want to play it, and how you want to play it.
And I'm curious also, sticking with my question about Cecil, is like, was he important to you as sort of a role model, as someone who had totally devoted his life to his art? Because you're not someone who's had like a regular job and played bass at night and on weekends. You know, you've kind of been fully committed since the 70s. So, you know, what gave you the ability to sort of make that commitment?
Well, I met Cecil in 1973. We played at Carnegie Hall in 1974. And even though I was playing this music, I grew up in a household where my grandfather didn't know how to read or write. And my mother and father, who made money and raised the family, raising the housing projects in the South Bronx, it was always about getting a job or going to college, or getting a job at the post office, doing something better than they did, you know, rather than, you know, well, grandfather's a sharecropper and everyone and people from the South would come to the North, and they would get a job, civil service job that they could keep, and so that was in me, and I was very conservative as far as that, because of that. But in 1975, I got married in 1975 to Patricia. And in 1975, I met Don Cherry, and he invited me to play at the Five Spot for a week with him. And right after that, Patricia encouraged me, and by that time, I did have a day job. So I had a job because, you know, we had to pay that $90 of rent was in, that $90 worth of rent. By the way, which I was always late on, by the way. But so she encouraged me to quit the day job and concentrate on music. She had that feeling and that impulse that this would work out. And that's what I did. I quit the job and I concentrated on music. And we got by. In 1980, December 1980, asked to join Cecil Taylor Unit at that time. So all of these, to go back to your exact question, Cecil and all the musicians, they at early stage, many musicians had day jobs. But as soon as there was an opening where, you know, I can't take this anymore, I got to be a musician, you have to play music, you have to concentrate on music. You can't, you know, I mean, if you have like a bunch of kids, then you have to do what you have to do. But if you don't have a bunch of, you don't have a family, and then you can concentrate on the music. And if you do have a family, you can concentrate on the music with the hope and faith that it will work out by hook or crook. And all of these musicians, you know, had devoted their life to music. And Cecil, in particular, went through a lot, you know, as far as, you know, people, you go to a club and, here comes that piano player. So nobody wants to play with them. They get up and they leave, being chastised that way, and to stick with the music that he wanted to play. Now, part of that is that you get to the point where it's so in you and you're so sure that what the music, this is the music, it gives you a lot of strength and fortitude. And this is not just with Cecil, it's with anybody playing the music they really believe in. And you're being told to get a day job, you're being told to play a more accessible music, and but it's not what you feel, it's not what you hear. So you have to follow your dreams and play what you think is important in life, you know. So that's the lesson I learned to all the strong and serious musicians who did that. And that was just about everybody. Everybody played music because they were a musician, and they have different systems and different ways of putting it together. You know, Don Cherry had his way, Cecil had his way, Gracian Moncourt, Sonny Murray. You name all the musicians, you know, Bill Dixon, Milford Graves, they all had a different way of putting the music together, but it all worked on its own level, and they were all committed from the day one till the day those who passed away have passed away, but they were committed until that day.
Yeah, yeah. How old were you, Patricia, when you first became interested in dance?
3.
So you've been just your whole life?
Yeah.
And where did you study, and did you dance as part of traditional companies or anything like that when you were coming up?
I had traditional training, but no, I didn't dance in any of the companies because I always wanted to improvise. That's really what I wanted to do. I studied ballet. I studied with a woman named Miss Jean Hamilton, who's an obscure, but some people know who she is. She was an important influence, but it's so long, it's so subtle now, long ago. But what you were talking to William about in your own voice, all of that training, the more training you have is great because it gives you a lot of vocabulary.
Uh-huh.
But it also interferes with your knowing yourself.
Okay.
And especially and I think this would be probably true of classical music training, would be like all of that has a lot of things like, are you doing it correctly? Are you right, or if you're not right, you're wrong? And so it's very difficult. You have to lose that filter to find who you are. And you always think that who you are when you're young, I think a common mistake is to think it's outside of yourself, when in fact it is inside of yourself, and it's just deep inside yourself, and then finding and being, so it's you know, being comfortable with who you are and not limiting who you are. You know, say I can only do this. I was working with this choreographer, which I rarely do actually, but and she's unusual, so I was working with her, and she was saying, I know who you are, I know how you move, because a lot of people have a way of moving, and that's their voice. But I don't like to be pigeonholed. I just don't like it. And so, and actually who I am is, I have a broad vocabulary. And it all speaks to different aspects of myself. And it's like being able to, you know, play more than one role, you know, in a way. But they're different voices to bring out different aspects of oneself. But you're still yourself. And it's like, it's overwhelmingly true. And being comfortable with that. But who you are is just where, like, we keep on being revealed to ourselves. We're not just this static thing. So that's what becoming an artist is being in touch with who you are. Yeah, I had a lot of ballet training. I studied with Graham. I studied with Hawkins technique. I studied with Graham and Cunningham and African, and I took one class in Balinese dancing once. Everything is just vocabulary, and then you take it in, and then you have to let it go. Mm-hmm. That's to find out your uniqueness is being able to take it in. Then you have to get rid of it and see what sticks, what is really coming from your own way of putting things together.
Mm-hmm.
And
So do you retain that kind of improvisatory nature when you're preparing a piece for multiple dancers? Like, how do you...
Yeah. And that took me long, because I didn't have enough... Working with multiple dancers is, that's a big responsibility. And as a director of Arts for Art, I don't often have that privilege. I did last year, I gave it to myself. And I've gotten way better, I think, and figured out how to bring out the uniqueness and give them a form. So, because most dancers aren't used to, you know, to be able to really improvise together, that's even more investment of time and energy.
Mm.
And it's not as common in the dance world. So, and when you have improvisation in the dance world, it's usually within a certain genre, like contact or some kind of postmodern style. Very specific, with, you know, a lot of rules and regulations. It's not very free. And it's actually my nature to, like I said, I don't like to be pigeonholed. It's my nature to want to break down all the walls around me. I don't like them. So there's not a common language for that in the dance world. And so I did come up with a way, I was really happy, it worked really well, of creating a real form that was specific enough that it gave people a structure in which they could be then free, so that they had the structure that they knew what they had to do when they had to do it, yet they could do what they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked well.
Like, you've got 2 minutes to get from A to B.
For example.
Yeah.
That could be, you know, right.
Yeah. So how did you two first meet? So you've been married since 1975, so how did, you know, did someone introduce you? How did you guys get together?
I went to Studio Rigby looking for musicians to work with who could improvise and were into us. I was trying to find someone. I hadn't heard of any of this music really right until right before it. I started describing to people what I wanted, and someone and who I just met took me to Studio Rigby because what I was describing was they thought I might find there. And it was Montu's first season at Studio Rigby.
So how quickly did you like develop a taste for the music? Did it work for you right away, or?
Well, there's the music. Well, the music is more complex than the music. I liked William. The reason I met William was specifically is I liked the composition that he had written for the Montu, and so I went to speak to him specifically because I liked his composition. And I would say some of the music it was just natural to me, and some of it I grew into. Like when I first heard Cecil Taylor, it put me to sleep literally, because it was overload. It overstimulated my brain, and my brain couldn't handle it, so it shut down. I fell asleep.
The exact same thing happened to me when I saw him at, I think, Avery Fisher Hall in 2001 or something like that. Because it was a solo set and then a trio set after, and during the solo set I just kind of, you know, went out and
right.
then came back.
You're not bored, it's like, you're like, oh my god, ugh.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like short circuit. But, and then it gradually, some of the music was much easier, you know, but basically it was where I just was where I wanted to be. And the weird thing is I would find it so much easier, and it would annoy me. I felt like I did a better job when I was dancing to structured music that I thought was simplistic. And I don't think I danced as well to this music when I first, because it took me a while to hear all the structures and understanding how I was, because if you can't hear all the structures, then you don't know how to interact with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it took, you know, I think I started doing things like, but this was like maybe 10 years in, I started humming my own counter melodies to make sure that I was placing myself clearly within the framework.
Oh, okay.
Of the music. So like if you're really part of the music, then you have to have your own line. You're not playing somebody else's line.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing your own line. So I would sort of sing to myself that. I did different things too. I also sometimes it was the title of the piece was became really important to me as a way of giving myself a framework. What is this about? What am I doing in the piece? So I would say a kind of a sense of a story, not a narrative story, but a. And I would say that I was like, if you compare it to painting, it's like I was I'm an impressionist. So it's not, you know, it has something to do with life, the world and nature and life, but it's not, you know, not literal representational.
I'm curious, you mentioned the titles of pieces being important, and I'm curious what your thought is about that. Like, what is the political value of instrumental music? Because, you know, you can give a piece any title that you want, but a listener is going to take away what they're going to take away. So,
right.
You know, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think that titles are hangers, and like that are very, they're built, or they're signboard, they're signposts. And signposts are very important for people's minds. They kind of like, oh, that's where I am. That's where I am, all right now. And so a title becomes important as a way in for anybody and give them some framework on which to hang their impressions. Mm. But I was always frustrated as a dancer that there was this literal quality to it. Basically, I'm a dancer who really wanted to, I don't know, wished that I could just be pure energy. That's why I relate to this music so well, because I related to it from, that was where I was coming from. It's the energy, it's not the visualness of it. Mm-hmm. It was the energy, the moving energy, but that's, it took me a long time to accept the fact that that's not how people saw it. Or not necessarily, and because I hadn't created enough signposts in my dancing. I was going so much for pure energy. Well, people, I'm not. I'm a physical, and so people would just sort of be overwhelmed at how much energy I had, and that was not the point.
I'm curious about the record that you two just made together, "Hope Cries for Justice." When and how did that sort of come together or come to you?
In many ways, a long time coming, because I've been talking about I wanted to do this, but then I didn't, you know. So in that sense, it's a long time coming. The lot of what's written was written maybe a few years ago. The storytelling ones, we had a rare week off in the country. We went to a country house for a week, and it was like I had time to write every day. And we were talking about this idea of vision as a character. I mean, I was talking about it, so that's where that came from. And the relationship with the music is something we've always worked on. It's not, I don't see it as, it's the same kind of relationship that I want in the dance, that I want in the word and music. I think of it as a duet, mm-hmm. not as an accompaniment. And it's why I was like holding back and leaving spaces, because that's the non-literal voice is the music. So because there's certain things that words just don't hold that are as much a part of the story as what the words hold.
I think it's interesting that, you know, for a lot of it you're sort of writing in character in a way, which kind of reminded me of Anna Deavere Smith to a degree, you know, just taking on other voices of immigrants and cops and stuff like that. So I mean, how did that all kind of come together for you?
It just is. It's like what I was, it's just how I am. It's acting. Mm-hmm. Is something, it would have been very easy for me to become an actress. That's just easy for me. It's my natural. Once I got angry and I couldn't express it, I knew if I expressed it in my angry voice, it would not have gone over well. So I instinctively yelled in a character's voice. This was in real life. And it was great because I was able to express myself and the person just looked at me like, but it wasn't, they at least weren't looking at me like this. It was, they didn't look at me in a combative way. They looked at me with surprise. So at least I was able to express it, but I expressed it in a character as a way of being heard. And so like playing characters is just easy for me. I mean, that's not usual, mm-hmm. but easy.
Yeah. And it kind of plays like a suite, like the tracks all sort of bleed into each other. So I mean, do you have any plans to like present it as a live piece?
Yeah, we have a little bit, and we want to work on it, and I'd like there to be visuals to it, and how we're going to accomplish that. Visual projections. And I want to make sure it's I want to make sure that it's really duet, a real duet, and that's important to me. I need to hear back from other people too. I want to make sure, I feel I'm not a young person anymore, and so it's important for me to get it right. Just want to get it right. And this is really, it's, as a presenter, I present what I present because I think it's important that it be heard and seen and part of the cultural dialogue. Mm-hmm. But I realized a lot of the sort of the sub, all the titling and the sub subtitles of what I do are really mine. And so I thought, well, I have to take responsibility and that on a personal level, because I actually believe that art makes a difference in that it does affect people on a deep level. And I have to get that out there mm-hmm. from me, because otherwise I'm just hoping it gets out there. But if it's not coming from me in a direct way, then I'm not being fully responsible to my vision.
Yeah, yeah. You've both been, to one degree or another, politically active like your whole adult lives. So, what would you consider victories that you've seen over the years?
Well, I don't want to take responsibility for any victories that have happened, because nothing happens because of any one thing. But I guess I could say, before Arts for Art and the Vision, before the Vision Festival, improvised music was dying out in America, and it is no longer.
And I guess the flip side of that is, what keeps you motivated to continue working when it seems like the entire system is either apathetic or, allied against you in a way?
Oh, I always made sure I kept it interesting, which meant that I kept making it more difficult to do. So I kept embellishing, if you really care about real diversity in the music, keeping its, its African-American roots, you have to figure out ways to do that, and that has education programs and as well as nurturing young talents, paying attention to also, like at the first Vision Festival, so from the very beginning, we not only had the political social justice subtext, we also had this idea that everyone is of value, that we're a community and every element of that community needs respect. So you respect not only the artists, but the volunteers and the writers, and everyone needs to be given respect. And so that's really been, we've tried to keep that as a through line. And it's like understanding how to serve all the aspects. And like you ask people, not everyone buys into community the way that I do. So you keep creating opportunities for that. But one of the things, what We Have Voice has been getting a lot of attention. And people asked me, well, what have our experience in terms of the Vision Festival? And one of the things is, I've never really heard any transgressions like that at the Vision Festival. And I think that's because it's so branded as an idealistic event that mm-hmm. people tend to behave themselves around it. I would say that there's just generally people are happy to be there. They're on their good behaviors. They want to be part of this, so they're not going to behave badly usually. And I haven't had any kind of, you know, real transgressions in those, in that regard.
Yeah, yeah. When do you start organizing each year's festival? Is it like the day after the previous one ends, or do you get like a little break in between?
I used to have a break. Now there are no breaks. And also the timeline changes because of grant cycles and because we're doing so many things. Like, you know, I have an early outline for next year's already.
Mm-hmm. This year's lineup, there are some really impressive young artists. There's like Jamie Branch's group. There's James Brandon Lewis, who's been around for a couple of years already. There's Irreversible Entanglements. I mean, are you excited by the presence of like new blood like that, both of you?
I'm not.
All right.
No, because this is... you answer that.
I'll answer it. All right, so... I have a saying that I came up with a number of years ago in terms of, by respecting the past, you make your presence stronger and you make possible a future where freedom is possible. Are you something like that? And it's very important to me that we support younger artists who are really strong. And there is an absurd discrimination in funding, so that almost all funding is for young people. There's no funding for mid-career artists or elder artists. It just doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's absurd, and it actually, because, and then there didn't used to be funding for young art. I mean, so the support is so unequal. So it does create a certain level of crankiness, and it's been around for a long, that discrimination has been around for quite a while, and it's only gotten worse. But I don't, you know, we work the way we work, and I don't worry about that so much in what I do. I think it's so important that we have some strong young people, that this group that you've mentioned, all these people are more, they relate more to the Vision Festival than others have in the past, where like they just happen to be young and they really have not that much to do with us. And like there was this, I was criticized about, I don't know, 10 years ago, but more than five, I think, somewhere in there, for not presenting enough young people. And my response was, you're right. And why is that? It's not, and the question isn't that I'm not willing, it's that where are they?
Mm-hmm.
And why aren't they relating to any of us or any of what we're doing and what we're offering? It's not an organic community then. So I'm trying to, you know, I have a lot of artist meetings so that to try to create opportunities for organic community.
Right. And on a pragmatic sort of level, for example, I mean, James Brandon Lewis has been playing at the other events that Arts for Art puts on, you know, for a couple of years
now. And Luke Stewart and Jane, yeah.
But like Jamie and Irreversible Entanglements, both of their albums did really well on critics' lists last year,
right,
including like websites that don't really cover that much jazz. So does that kind of thing translate to drawing power in your experience?
That's a PR algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it works. And it does. There's not an automatic, like someone is big in a certain area, doesn't necessarily translate because, for example, I think it does. I think it will and does because we're trying to work within that. We're trying to take care of that.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not an automatic because when we book mainstream people, you don't get that much of the mainstream crowd, for example. Not that we did a lot of that, but we've done some. Because the lines of definition between the genres or streams of music are not the lines we draw.
Right.
Okay, so we've gone outside of our stream to include others, and it doesn't always bring their crew.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, people think in terms of streams. So
yeah.
You have to really work to break through that.
All the, like, you know, the musicians you mentioned, Jamie Branch and James Brandon Lewis, they're now members of the Little Huey Creative Music Orchestra, the last version of it, you know, Brendan Lopez. And so it's always the older musicians who are supposed to nurture and help and inspire and learn from the younger musicians as well as they're supposed to learn from us. And so it'd be like an exchange. And it happens. It can't happen with everybody. There are too many younger musicians around here. There are too many. Every year more musicians are coming to New York. They're graduating. But I think that it's very good that they're playing, no matter what age you are, and trying to make some music in this world. I think it's a very, very, very positive thing, and I just hope that people can continue to do it on a high level. That will get out here. I mean, I know nothing about social media and what draws, and you know, I'm not connected with the Vision Festival in that way, as far as organizing and things like that. Although I used to get a lot of credit for organizing the Vision Festival, and I correct it every time now because I even when I say I don't, people, you know, they come on, no, but I don't. Mm-hmm. And but
it's an example actually of sexism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
It just is.
It seems like you guys are in one spot for a year or two and then the festival moves again.
Yeah.
So why do venues decide against hosting you from year to year? Is it because they don't want to block out a whole week, or is it
no,
they
it's
want
actually
too much,
no. It's not actually like that almost at all. It's more random. Well, it's not random. It's usually our decision. Right, but the reason we're not back at Judson is two reasons. One is people just were so unhappy with the sound. Even though last year the sound was much better than it had been, we had done things. But the other thing is they're talking about renovating, and so they couldn't promise us a space. But we would have probably left anyway because of too many complaints, too much. You have to be responsible for. I love roulette. In lots of ways, it's best acoustically. They're really lovely to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so are the people at Judson, actually. Wonderful to work with. So it's not as good in other ways, but we'll see. I noticed myself in this rant that it just so happened that we were usually in every venue in many of the venues for about 3 years. That seems to be what happens. That's just how it fell. You know, sometimes, like, I think we were at St. Patrick's Youth Center for a long time, or I guess for 3 years probably. But they, I think, wanted, I don't know, it became a difficult thing.
Have you ever been approached about, for lack of a better word, franchising? Like somebody saying to you, we love the Vision Festival, come do one in Stockholm, or, you know, something like that?
A little. And I would say one of the problems that we had was that I did too much by myself for too long. And so it meant that I didn't have time to do outreach. We're beginning to address that, although there was a vision night at the Salon d'Hiver Festival a few years, and there was one time in Italy, and we're gonna do next year something at Tufts University, but it'll be a one-day thing. Mm-hmm. But we're working on, we want to actually, it's not quite franchising it, but something. We want to spread it out, because there's a whole ethos. It's not just an aesthetic and ethos behind it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Arts for Art is a nonprofit, and you guys have no corporate sponsorship, right? So how do you keep the lights on without doing like crowdfunding and other kinds of direct outreach to fans and stuff
like
that?
We do direct outreach. not crowdfunding, but mm-hmm. We have fundraisers and stuff. Yeah, we have the artist campaign and the vision campaign. Mm-hmm. And that's how we do it through, actually, I think, I would say at least 60% of our income comes from direct donations, maybe more. Mm-hmm. Then we get, you know, government support, not big. We're still like small, really small, but that may change because we're looking for a venue now. Once you have a venue, your budget triples or more, mm-hmm. because just having a venue, I mean, it just changes everything. And that is our next big goal. Can you just think of it every night? Let's go to...
Because I noticed you've been doing more and more programs, like the Evolving Music Series, the Underline shows, the Gardens performances. So, I mean, do you have those planned for 2018 as well, like after the festival?
Yep. Yes. Do you want me to run it down?
No. I just wanted to know if the stuff in the fall was going to be continuing.
Yes,
as well.
Everything is continuing while we, but after the festival, our focus is going to be trying to find a venue. But we will keep all the programming that we've been doing until we get a venue, and then we'll be doing 10 times more programming.
Does something like Winter Jazz Fests, because that seems to get bigger every year now, does that help contribute to an overall atmosphere that builds an appreciation that, you know, then flows over to you guys? It does not. A rising tide does not lift all boats.
I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, it's really hard to... I mean, it must help a little, because... Mm-hmm. It must help a little, but not so as you would notice. Mm-hmm. I'm happy for everything that happens.
I find the Winter Jazz Fest is kind of like the corporate thing, like the New Orleans Jazz Festival, where people are just coming out and they're going from club to club, and they don't really know all the time who's playing, and you know, and then. You know, so it's a little
it's
different.
Like going
it's not
to
a selected, yeah, thing. But I remember one year we played with Rashid Ali and Charles Gayle, and because of it,
at
I mean this
Winter
is when
Jazz.
We got a gig at the Newport Jazz Festival from that festival. But that's because the guy who books Newport happened to be in the audience. Mm-hmm. So things happen. But I think that it's, you know, it just sort of happens by, you know, by itself.
I don't know if that's going on, though, still. I don't know that, I mean, it's...
Because it is for promoters and everyone to come look at bands.
It's like
a showcase to look at the band.
It's like South by Southwest.
Yeah, like South by Southwest, yeah.
Yeah, so...
So I hope that it helps individual artists, but there's this trending thing, the whole idea of trending, is really the wrong way to look at art. And it's the way it seems to be going.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the new thing? It's is not really respecting what art is, actually. Yeah. Art isn't about trends.
Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, it seems like every few years, you know, out jazz kind of has a moment, you know, like Rolling Stone says, oh, hey, look over here, you know, or, you know, right. like Jamie's album makes it to a bunch of critics' lists, you know, and stuff like that. And it's like, it's the gears click into place every once in a while. So, you know, you kind of have to be ready when it, you know, when it happens.
Right. I know, right. You know, thank God it happens every once in a while. But the concept is wrong.
I mean, it would be nice if we had our own gears that clicked in. We had our own equivalent to a big magazine. We had a little bit more power in the business structure of the way things
but
are.
The business, but all business structure is geared towards the young because they're the main consumers. And so everything, you know, so big business in every element, even if it's not that big, is looking towards them. And that's why, like, it's particularly annoying that the funding is also. So it's all coming together to look at what's new, young, emerging. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't sustain the development and the creativity. It's not good for our culture as a whole that everything is looking that way.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're dead. I mean, when you die, then you get a little more play.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I feel like the old sort of cross-generational apprenticeship system doesn't exist now and hasn't existed for a long time. But there's also all these young players that are coming out of music school. You know, they come out of the New School or Berklee or wherever, and they all form bands with the people they went to school with, you know, or the person who lives down the street who's also 25. You know, there's not that case of, you know, younger players and older players working together as much.
Yeah, and the younger players, I mean, this is not entirely true, thank God, but the younger players don't want to play with the older players. Or they do only to get it on their resume. They're only thinking about, like, oh, what can I put so I can prove I can play with so-and-so and so. So therefore, then, once having played with them, the elder is irrelevant. Because it's just a stepping stone to prove their validity. Now, I'm talking in a big generalization here. This is... nothing is entirely true, and I know real exceptions to this, but it's so I'm just talking of it in that way.
Yeah.
It's really bad. It's bad for the music. It's because there's no development. Because what are they learning? They're learning from someone who's telling them what is right and what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to have what Wilbur, you know, William was taught, you know, Wilbur Ware told them, it's wrong until you sound like only you. They're just not gonna, they're not getting that experience.
Yeah. And I mean, part of the problem is, it's interesting because there's not like a record business anymore where they'll take a 20-year-old piano player and pair him up with Ron Carter and Billy Higgins or somebody, you know, and say, here, this is your rhythm section for your album. You know, or something like that. You know, there's no farm system like that anymore. So if you're not looking to play with older people and learn from them, nobody's going to make you.
Right.
William, I wanted to ask you about the box set that you just put out, which is Pieces with Vocalists. What made you decide to draw people's attention to that side of your music? Did you feel like it was an overlooked element of your body of work?
Well, the previous recording with vocal music was Stan's hat flapping in the wind. And then I had done a voice, an evening, I guess in January, of vocal music at Roulette. And so, and that had various singers and various compositions and setups for vocalists. And so the originally Voices Fall from the Sky was supposed to be a 10 CD set, because I have and I was talked out of that for business reasons and to sort of hold back on that yet. And it ended up being a 3-CD set with some of the new material. One CD is all new material from some of the stuff we did at Roulette, and then some other stuff that was written after Roulette. And then the rest is sort of a sampling of things that have already been released with different singers. That kind of, see, the good thing about not having publicity for CDs is that you can put them out again and you still have that a large audience that never heard of what you've done or is aware of it. So it's sort of a sampling of all of different styles and ways of vocal music that I've done.
Can I make a
comment? The last years.
I mean, William is as much an author or a writer of words. He's always worked with singers, well, I think since the 70s. And he's probably alone in, or almost alone in that. But he's just, he's always worked with voice. And so it's like, it was a natural thing. And vocal music was not appreciated in a lot of the free jazz world. And
yeah,
it's beginning to be more so. It's at least as there are more and more singers. And so it was, it's just something he's always done. And so it makes sense, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there were only a few singers, you know, in the 60s and 70s, and then, you know, it was always, like you say, considered primarily instrumental music.
Yeah, people would be angry. They didn't want it. There's a singer up there? Get her off the stage. Burn her at the stake. No.
Yeah. I guess my last question is, because you said you're already working on next year's Vision Festival, do you have any concept for the 25th anniversary or anything like that? Is there anything?
That's 2 years from now? No, I haven't. Well, I know it's coming. I'm hoping I would love it if we have the venue in place by then, but that would be fantastic. You know, the only way to continue is to keep looking towards the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so you celebrate your past, but you're really looking towards the future. That way you're relevant. And especially nowadays, where time is like speeding up.
Yeah.
We just want to make sure that the future is humane and livable and creative.
It's weird. I almost feel like now that the regular traditional record industry is kind of not dying, because people really exaggerate that. I mean, there's still billions of dollars sloshing around, you know, but I feel like now that the traditional CDs in stores model is fading away and stuff like Bandcamp is moving in, there's a path to a more organic musical community than there was in the past, you know, even if it's like geographically distributed. I mean, I do a lot of work with Bandcamp, like writing articles for their website and stuff like that, and you can really sort of pull people's attention to things that they never noticed in the past, like what William was saying. I mean, I wrote a big article for them about Aramite Records because he put all his stuff up on Bandcamp, and so it's like, hey, here are these records from 15 years ago that you never heard about before, you know,
right.
And they're still very much worth hearing.
Yeah. Well, Kid Jordan said something in an interview about this music, that this music is still in the future. I don't remember his language, but is there something about it that's never, you can't date it, because it's, how can you date something that's based on being authentic to who you are?
Mm-hmm.
It's really not time-based. It's, and if it's authentic, and not only to who you are, but to developing your voice. So it's like something that's it's not, you know, a catchy rhythm. It's not a particular defined sound. It's a defined commitment to being uniquely yourself,
mm-hmm.
not unique, like trendy, not like gimmicky, but, you know, not playing with knives and forks or whatever. It's like playing, you know, letting your sound develop. So it never gets old. How can it get old? How can it get dated?
Mm-hmm.
And people try to talk about it as though it were dated. And the only thing that the reason I think, well, first of all, I think it was always there. It had to have been always there in some way. But, and I think that it came up when it came up because it was a time where people could imagine being free. Coming out of the 50s and 60s, there's a sense of self-empowerment, and it was definitely linked to the African-American. This music is from that tradition. And so that's when they felt there was a universal feeling of, like, I can be who I am. Now it's coming up again because it's the opposite almost, because it's being, we're in such a political crisis, a social crisis, that playing free is like an act of defiance. And an act of, like, you know, we're not going to let it go just because the whole thing. And especially as it's gotten to this place. I would say a few years ago, not so much. I could feel like there was so much pressure to do compositional work, mm-hmm. as opposed to improvised work. All the compositional work was getting funding. If you wanted to get funding, you had to prove that you were a real composer, in quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's a... You know, there's that resistance coming up in the music. And then, you know, some people play free because they're not feeling oppressed. And some, you know, there's, so it's, and it has a different quality.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was coming up, like in junior high school, and an album cost $3.50. And so, like, say, for instance, you know, Sonny Rollins would come out with this record, East Broadway Rundown. And so, I don't know where we got the $3.50, me and my brother. We'd get it, and we'd go down to Stan's record store, and we'd buy it. And we have it in the bag, and we come home and just put it down. Then we go in the kitchen and make our sandwiches. And we made our sandwiches and have our drinks, and we, you know, come down, put our sandwich out. And then we didn't put the record on yet. We just look at the cover. It had that orange cover. And we just look at the painting for a while. And then we'd open it up and we'd read the liner notes and then see if there's anybody we hadn't heard of, any painter, any writer we hadn't heard of. And then we'd look up the writer in the book. And then we would have a little bite of sandwich and then we put on the first side. And then it didn't say Freddie Hubbard on the record. And then we heard this trumpet come out of nowhere. And so we'd look, and then we'd look at every aspect of the record we'd look. And that record would be examined and re-examined for 2-3 weeks. And it was just so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if just streaming you get that much of a fun out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe people do. But I mean, that's what I didn't want to lose, because then now, what's the next record coming out on Impulse? And what's this happening? And then, you know, it was just a lot of fun and a lot of joy in having something you can look at. And it took me a long time to get used to CDs.
When I, it's funny, because I was just having a conversation with somebody about this, because they were talking about how, you know, somebody said, it's better for a writer to live with a piece of art for 2-3 months before they write something about it, rather than having to write about it the next day.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, man, I've been writing about music, you know, since 1996. if I have 2 weeks before my before a review is due, that's a lot. Like The Wire, they'll give me like a week sometimes. They'll be like, I need you to review this album and I need the review on Thursday, and it's like Saturday.
Yeah.
I'm like, all right, I'll do it, you know. But and the thing that I said to him was, I said, you know, honestly, it helps, number one, that I stay in my lane. Like, I mostly write about jazz and metal. You know, those are my two things. Those are the things I know, so I do that.
Right.
But it also helps that, honestly, like, it's been a long time since I heard a record that required 2 months to give up its secrets. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of stuff is right there on the surface anyway.
Right.
So it's like, all right, I got you. I get it. I'm, you know, I'm done. But...
Well, see, that's writing about it. But those same albums... If you age with them a little bit, then you begin to, and especially if you come away from them, then go back to them, which I've done. You know, I've gotten some albums that I liked when I was a teenager, and they don't stand up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, because I said, well, they don't. And then some albums stand up. So it's just interesting. And then it depends on the time of day you listen. The effect it has on you in a particular mood. So there's all kinds of things. But the main thing, you know, is that any kind of music, and this is something Mary Baraka would always say, you know, is better than dropping bombs on people. even the worst music is better than bombing a village.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So there's always something there somewhere that you know, guys practiced, they worked on it, because I remember in Downbeat, there used to be guys that sang, they used to give it no stars,
mm-hmm.
and they'd say, this music, I'm not equipped to review this record. You know, because they said, they knew something was there, but they said, I don't get it, and I'm not equipped to review this record, so they wouldn't review it. And then when Kenny Durham was reviewing Albert Isla, you know, he would say, stuff like, this record sounds like the Salvation Army band on LSD. And when you read a review like that, you say, I got to go buy that. What does that sound like?
Yeah.
You know, so there's all kinds of levels and ways of dealing with this stuff. But it's, you know, it's fun. I'm just old school. I can't really, I'm hoping, I really wish the record, if I had money, I'd open up record stores and bring it back. I really would.
I hear you.
I can't figure out a reason why Virgin Records would close. They had magazines, they had coffee, they had DVDs. Right there on 14th Street, they had foot traffic. They could have had live bands playing there. And like, it was some kind of, somebody would tell me, what was the decision for all the record stores to close? Who made that, and how did it happen?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that'd be a good thing to find out.
Yeah.
Okay, that was my interview with William Parker and Patricia Nicholson, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast, which, as I mentioned up top, is part of the Osiris Podcast Network. Visit osirispod.com to check out all their other shows and see if any of them appeal to you. And again, please consider donating to patreon.com/burningambulance to support this podcast and the Burning Ambulance website directly. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.
Osiris.